Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from a panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Candace, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Living with Advanced Skin Cancer. And today's program is focused on living with advanced basal cell and squamous cell cancers and really new perspectives in their treatment. And today's program is, this is part one of the three-part series, and it's really wonderful to have so many of you on the call today. This is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, as well as skin cancer organizations as well. And it's because of that collaboration and your interest in the program today that we have so many of you on the call today. We have over 552 participants on the call today, and you come from all of the United States. We also have international participants from Canada and the United Kingdom. So it's really a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us, and we're delighted to have you on the call. Today's program is supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb, Novartis Oncology, and a grant from Genentech, and I really want to thank them for their support and for their collaborative corporate partnership in making this program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Alan Ho. Dr. Ho is medical oncologist, Department of Medicine, Head of Neck Oncology Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Ho is going to present on an overview of advanced skin cancers, including advanced basal cell and advanced squamous cell cancers. He will present the standard of care and new treatment approaches, as well as emerging role of targeted therapy, and he will present some clinical trial updates. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Ho.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us on the call. So what I'd like to do today is just discuss some of the drug treatment approaches for advanced skin cancers, both basal cell and advanced squamous cell cancers, and also give you a little bit of insight about regarding just a fraction of some of the clinical trials that are being performed now to develop new treatments for these diseases. First off, I have to say that on our service, we treat both advanced basal cell and squamous cell cancers, but it's important to recognize that while both of these tumors arise in the skin, they are very different diseases driven by different tumor biologies and hence are treated in different ways, and I hope to highlight that. I'd also like to point out that what the definition of advanced skin cancer is for our talk. So most early stage cancers, basal cell cancers or squamous cell cancers, are usually easily treated by resection with your dermatologist or with a surgeon, and and less frequently by radiation. Advanced skin cancers that we'll be talking about today are really those that are not amenable to curative treatments like resection or radiation, either because the tumors are no longer responsive to radiation or surgery or too large for radiation or surgery, or because the tumor has spread to different parts of the body. So in those situations where radiation and surgery are no longer appropriate treatments, drug treatments or chemotherapy or molecular target treatments, these are all the same different terminology for the same thing. But using drugs to fight your cancer becomes more of an important or critical strategy. And that's what I primarily do. I'm a medical oncologist who administer drugs to treat cancer. It's important to recognize also that in the setting of advanced cancers and using drug treatments to fight these diseases, while the drug can be effective for many patients, the overall goal of these treatments is not necessarily to eliminate the cancer completely, because the drugs often don't have the capacity to do that. But in fact, to use these drugs to effectively shrink and control the tumors for long periods of time. And doing so by also balancing out the patient's quality of life. So moving forward, just starting with basal cell cancers. So basal cell cancers, is a very common malignancy, of course, usually very curable with a surgical resection. But when advanced and can't be treated with radiation or surgery, the first thing that one often thinks about is treatment indicated? So in some cases, basal cell cancers can spread to the lungs. And if it's just in the lungs, these tumors can sometimes grow slowly or not at all for months or even years. And so under the care and supervision of an experienced physician, some of these cases can simply be observed. But if the tumor is progressive, growing, or causing a symptom or threatening organ function, or more importantly, if the tumor is advanced and in the skin and continually growing, causing ulcerations, etc., oftentimes treatment is indicated in those situations. Thankfully, over the last several years, there has been a revolution in the development of treatments for advanced basal cell cancers. And specifically, these include drugs that target the very genes that are changed or altered in these tumors and which really define what these tumors are. The genetic pathway that's targeted is called the hedgehog signaling pathway, and the drugs that target it are called hedgehog pathway inhibitors. The first that was developed and now FDA approved is Vismodegib or Erivedge, and the second that's been approved is Sonitegib. Both of these drugs can be very effective for shrinking and controlling advanced basal cell cancers. Both are taken orally on a daily basis. Using these two drugs as an example, the way that typically one would approach treatment for all advanced skin cancers, but also advanced basal cell skin cancers, is after having determined that treatment is required, one would do an initial baseline assessment of what the disease looks like. Whether if it's in the skin, it's making measurements of the tumor in the skin. If the tumor has spread to other internal organs, it would be performing radiologic studies to evaluate the size and location of those tumors. And then it would be initiating treatments. And then initiating treatment on the drug. And in this case, for basal cancers, it would be either Vismodegib or Sonitegib. The goals of the treatment, of course, are to make sure that it's effective against the cancer. That means that the cancers are no longer growing or shrinking. And secondly, that the patients tolerate it well and that their quality of life is either preserved or improved. So as you go along in treatment, both of those aspects need to be assessed. With regards to the drug working against the tumor, you have to make careful measurements, either of the tumor in the skin or with radiologic studies, to prove that the drug is actually stabilizing or shrinking the tumor. If it's growing through the treatment, which can happen, then you take that as a sign that the drug is no longer working and you discontinue it and move on to another treatment. And then for the second aspect, maintenance of quality of life, this is an important factor for your physician to continually monitor and to manage. Certainly these drugs carry with them side effects, which I think Dr. Lakatour will get into in his talk. And it's important that a dialogue between the patient and the physician is maintained to ensure that all side effects are accounted for and can be managed. And in some situations, that management would require holding drug treatment or even rare situations, discontinuing drug treatment. In the end, the drug treatment has to be both effective and tolerable for it to really benefit patients. And if both of those conditions are met, then the drug will be continued in an open-ended fashion, maintaining patients on these medications and continuing on with the assessments for both the effectiveness of the treatment and for tolerability. So that's the paradigm for treatment for advanced skin cancers across the board, and certainly applies to how we use these hedgehog pathway inhibitors, Vismodegib and Sonitegib. Moving on to squamous cell cancers, the difference with squamous cell cancers is oftentimes we don't usually take the opportunity to assess the growth rates of those tumors before treating. We know invariably that these tumors can grow, and so we initiate treatment immediately once having diagnosed patients with advanced squamous cell cancers. Currently, there are no specific standard treatments, and what I mean by that, treatments that have been demonstrated in a clinical trial providing evidence of benefit to the extent that the Food and Drug Administration, or the FDA, has approved the drug for its use in squamous cell cancers. Regardless, there are a list of effective drugs that we can use in this disease that we've developed through either experience or extrapolating from other similar diseases. They include traditional chemotherapy drugs that are administered through the vein that we use in other cancers that are also of the squamous cell variety, like head and neck cancers and throat cancers. These include drugs such as cisplatin or Taxol or 5-fluorouracil, if those ring a bell. But in terms of targeted approaches, what has also been developed in this disease are a couple clinical trials showing that drugs that target a protein that's called EGFR can be effective for, again, stabilizing or shrinking squamous cell cancers of the skin. The two drugs that have been developed in clinical trials include cetuximab and panitumumab. Cetuximab is probably used a little bit more just because of people's familiarity with it. This is not a traditional chemotherapy drug, but instead an antibody that was developed to bind to the EGFR protein on cancer cells. It's administered through the vein through an intravenous infusion and can be given either weekly or every other week. And you take the same approach as I just described for basal cancers, where you make a baseline assessment of the tumors, initiate treatment, monitor patients' quality of life and toxicities, manage those side effects and toxicities, again, which what Dr. Lacouture will review, and then reassessing the tumors on treatment to ensure that the drug treatment is effective. And so for squamous cell cancers, you can choose among those traditional chemotherapy drugs and these EGFR-targeted approaches. With regards to clinical trials, the one thing I wanted to touch upon is that what is being investigated now in several different trials is how effective immunotherapies may work in skin cancer patients. As you may know, immunotherapies are newly developed drug treatments that don't necessarily attack the tumor directly, but are really designed to activate one's own immune system to recognize the tumor as foreign, attack it, and to cause tumor regressions. Some of these therapies have already been FDA approved in other diseases, including in melanoma. While these can be very effective treatments, what we are learning is that the degree of effectiveness or the number of patients for which these treatments can be effective will vary depending upon disease. A melanoma patient population will respond differently to these therapies than, say, a colon cancer patient population. And so the only point to be made there is that these treatments need to be evaluated in the context of clinical trials to really understand how well they work for advanced skin cancers. Having said that, there are a number of reasons why I feel that these treatments have a good rationale for working in advanced skin cancer patients, and we anxiously await the completion of those trials to really understand if this is a viable therapeutic approach for patients. The very last thing I'll say is that, in the end, advanced skin cancers are relatively rare entity. Most skin cancers are readily addressed with surgery and or radiation. So advanced skin cancers where surgery or radiation are not usually the first modality of treatment is a rare entity. In that context, here at Memorial, at least, we look at the genetic aberrations that occur in those patients' tumors with the hopes of identifying new genetic targets for which clinical trials might be applied. In some situations, this does lead to the identification of a new drug or clinical trial that a particular patient may want to try. In other situations, and in fact in the majority of situations, we get a lot of good information from these genetic analyses that may not be applicable at the present time, but may be useful down the road. For most rare diseases, such as advanced skin cancers, if available, try to do genomic profiling, understanding that it won't always affect my clinical management, but with the hopes of finding new information about the tumor that will help guide treatment. And with that, I think my time is up. So that's a very general overview of our approach to treating advanced skin cancers, the agents that we utilize, the immunotherapy clinical trials that are ongoing for these diseases. And I'm happy to take questions at the end.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Ho. That was outstanding and just really very, very informative to everyone. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next presenter is Dr. Mario Lacatoire. Dr. Lacatoire is Director, Oncodermatology Program, Associate Attending Physician, Department of Dermatology, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Associate Professor of Dermatology, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Lacatoire is going to address managing treatment side effects, discomfort and pain, tips for caring for your skin during cancer treatments, some safety tips, and guidelines for communicating with healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Lacatoire.
Thank you, Carolyn. And also, I would like to thank all of you participating in the call today. As you have heard from Dr. Ho, there have been remarkable advances in the treatment of advanced skin cancers, including basal cell carcinomas and squamous cell carcinomas. And the improvement in treatment of these tumors have become so remarkable that now side effects have become even more prominent because people not only want to live longer, but they also want to live better lives. And it's important in doing so to communicate any side effect that you may be having during your treatment with your oncologist team or with the nurse that is part of that team so that any side effect can be managed earlier and more effectively. As with any other medical condition, side effects, the earlier they are treated, the better the results will be. And what are the side effects that we see with therapies in advanced basal or squamous cell carcinomas? So Dr. Ho very clearly described these new treatments that have been approved for advanced basal cell carcinomas that go by the names of bismotigib or zanidigib. These are drugs that are taken as pills every day and have been associated with a number of side effects that are not very severe in nature, but can be very limiting in the sense that they affect people every day and do not allow most people to continue on therapy for long periods of time if they are not treated effectively. So what are the side effects of the so-called hedgehog pathway inhibitors for advanced basal cell carcinoma, bismotigib and zanidigib? First, hair loss is very common with these drugs, although they are considered to be the so-called targeted drugs that only block the specific protein in advanced basal cell carcinoma, they also result in loss of hair. This hair loss can be mitigated to some degree with the use of topical formulations such as the over-the-counter product minoxidil, or if a specialist in hair loss is counseled, they may also recommend oral medications to treat hair loss that have been approved already, for example, finasteride or spironolactone. Another common side effect with hedgehog pathway inhibitors that can affect up to a third to half of people taking these drugs is these very painful muscle cramps that can affect especially the legs and the abdomen or trunk. These cramps can occur any time of day and night and do not appear to be relieved by exercise or by hydration. What really appears to work for these muscle cramps is the medication that blocks these calcium channel receptors that are commonly used for high blood pressure. So the so-called calcium channel blockers that are prescribed by your doctor have been shown to mitigate these painful muscle cramps that develop from the hedgehog pathway inhibitors. Other side effects from hedgehog pathway inhibitors that can be debilitating include weight loss and also taste changes. It turns out that for unknown reasons, these drugs affect the taste buds in the tongue, and people report that the food doesn't have any taste to it, that water tastes like cardboard, and that food really has no taste, which further exacerbates this weight loss that can occur with these drugs. Therefore, cooling the food, using plastic utensils, placing a lot of spices in your food, and using, for example, flavored water, flavored juices, may allow people to consume more calories and maintain their weight. Now, in terms of managing these side effects, it's important to discuss them with your oncologist as early as possible. And when you experience any of these side effects, I would avoid going online and searching for a lot of information that may not be verified by the medical community and may result in the worsening of these side effects and may even lead to the need for your medication to be stopped. So as early as possible, communicate with your oncologist and their team, either by calling them on the phone or by communicating via any other method that your oncologist would prefer. Some oncologists prefer to be emailed or through a special portal system they have through their hospital. Any way that your oncologist prefers to be communicated with, that should be the way that should be done as early as possible. Now, Dr. Ho also talked about advanced squamous cell carcinoma and the variety of these different drugs that are used to control this condition. There are several drugs that he mentioned, and I would like to start with the first one Dr. Ho mentioned, called cisplatin. This drug is, again, administered through the vein, like most of the other drugs that we will be talking about for advanced squamous cell carcinoma. And this drug is associated usually with nausea and vomiting that can be controlled or prevented by medications given before every infusion, diarrhea, and hair loss. The diarrhea to cisplatin can also be treated either with an over-the-counter product like Imodium or with other medications that are prescribed by your oncologist. It's important to communicate to your oncologist and when you have diarrhea so that additional weight loss or dehydration does not occur. The second drug Dr. Ho mentioned was fluorouracil, another drug given through the vein, also causing diarrhea, which can be managed as we discussed previously, also can cause some nausea, and can also cause taste changes. Again, those taste changes with these drugs can be mitigated with the cooling down of the foods, adding spices to the foods, and using plastic utensils or flavored drinks whenever needed. The third drug is Taxol or paclitaxel or docetaxel. Again, given through the vein, this drug may be effective in some cases of an advanced squamous cell carcinoma, but it's not devoid of side effects, resulting in these joint pains or these pains all over the body, which can be prevented and treated with, again, medications given by your doctor. They can also result, the paclitaxel and docetaxel, in low blood counts. In other words, your white blood cells can be reduced, and your red blood cells can be reduced. Thankfully, oncologists are very good at monitoring for these side effects and at any sign that these need to be replaced, either by a transfusion or by a medication to stimulate the formation of these white blood cells. These are procedures that will be done readily so that you can maintain your energy and your quality of life during treatment. And finally, with taxanes, another side effect that can linger for a long time is the so-called neuropathy. Neuropathy is a condition that results from these drugs in which the tiny little nerves in the fingertips and in the toe tips can be damaged by the chemotherapy, resulting in an absence of sensation, so the toes and the fingers feel numb, and when you walk, you may not be able to feel how you step all the time. And this can occur usually during treatment and resolve, but it appears that it may last for months after therapy is even completed. So I would recommend to prevent neuropathy from these therapies, and there is some evidence that using or holding ice packs in your hands and feet during the treatment is able to prevent the development of this so-called neuropathy in the hands and feet, probably by preventing blood flow into the hands and feet, which carries the chemotherapy. If the neuropathy has already occurred, your oncologist may recommend certain medications that will minimize this sensation of pins and needles, and these include drugs that are able to taper down or to tame down those nerve endings that are firing so readily after being damaged by the chemotherapy. Other type of medications that Dr. Ho mentioned include the so-called epidermal or EGFR inhibitors, epidermal growth factor receptor inhibitors, also given through the veins. These medications also have shown efficacy against advanced squamous cell carcinoma, but again are associated with many preventable side effects, including an acne-like rash that affects the face, scalp, and upper chest. It can be reduced by more than half with the use of an oral antibiotic given from the first day of this type of therapy, and also the use of topical corticosteroid or anti-inflammatory creams prescribed by your doctor. Diarrhea is also common with these EGFR inhibitors and, again, can be treated with Imodium or other more potent antidiarrheals prescribed by your doctor. Dry skin, hair thinning, and nails, brittle nails or ingrown nails can also develop with these EGFR inhibitors, but thankfully we've had so much experience with these drugs as they've been around for more than 10 years that in most cases, most dermatologists and oncologists will be able to mitigate them so that they do not result in any impediment in terms of daily activities or quality of life. And then finally, a new class of drugs that are currently being investigated, one of which was approved for this very rare type of skin cancer called Merkel cell carcinoma, are the so-called immunotherapies. And these immunotherapies have been revolutionary because oncologists are now able to administer these drugs usually through the vein, and they result in the activation of a person's immune system. This immune system, thankfully, will recognize any cancer cells as being foreign or unknown. Therefore, they will more likely be attacked by these by a person's own immune system, resulting in the approval of these drugs for a variety of other cancers and this rare type of skin cancer called Merkel cell carcinoma. The important thing in terms of side effects with these drugs is that it is not only the cancer that these immune cells will recognize, but the immune system in a person receiving these drugs will become so active that it is able to attack any part of that person's body. So, for example, person receiving these drugs, their immune system can attack their intestines, resulting in this painful diarrhea that thankfully can be treated by oncologists with the use of other medications, that are called TNF inhibitors or corticosteroids. The immune system can also be activated to such a degree that other innocent bystanders in the body can also be under attack. The skin can be attacked, causing this very itchy rash affecting the entire body. Thankfully, medications such as those corticosteroids taken by mouth or applied as creams or sprays can also mitigate this. Glands deep inside your body can also be affected when receiving immunotherapies, and your immune systems can attack these innocent glands, resulting in decreased levels of hormones that are produced by these glands. But again, Oncologists are so good at monitoring any changes in your body that they will be able to replenish most of these with no additional consequence. So in summary, all of the side effects that can appear and are likely to appear with the majority of these drugs are recognizable with the knowledge that they may occur by being prepared and by informing your oncologist team as early on. As the earlier that they are informed, the better they may be able to treat these side effects so that the side effects do not affect a person's quality of life, and importantly, that person can continue receiving their therapy and the benefit from these medications. Interestingly, with many of these drugs, it has been demonstrated that the worse the side effects, the better the anti-cancer effects of these drugs will be. So people that develop side effects, it may be that the drug is more effective in their bodies against the cancer, but also resulting in the side effects. And these are precisely those people that we want to control them, the problems, the side effects that occur, so they can receive the maximum benefit from their therapy. With that, I would like to conclude and thank you all very much for being today on this call.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Alexis, for that. It was outstanding and lots of wonderful information for everybody on the call, and I'm sure there'll be questions for you also during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Elizabeth Ezra. Ms. Ezra is an oncology social worker, and she's program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Ms. Ezra is going to address the free psychosocial services and support programs that we offer at Cancer Care, as well as the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my dear colleague and esteemed colleague, Ms. Ezra.
At this important call today, I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with advanced skin cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how cancer care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit or organization that provides free professional support to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs, including individual counseling, support groups, either over the telephone or online, educational resources, and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance, as well as some chemo copayment assistance, are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have similar problems. These connections can help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are safe places where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a general patient telephone support group. Cancer Care can also provide some limited financial assistance for transportation expenses. If you are interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call our Hope line at 1-800-813-4673 or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you can find a lot of additional information on your cancer diagnosis and the treatment you will need to receive. You have learned from today's program that there's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Your social worker can help you prioritize and actually rehearse the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and the information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to speak with you today.
Oh, thank you so much. We're grateful and so everyone now knows all the services that you can access from Cancer Care, and we are simply a telephone call away or a mouse click away in terms of accessing our services from our website as well. Well, now we do have time for questions. I'm going to ask Candace to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. So you already queued up for questions, I see. So Candace will explain to you how to queue up for questions, so everyone knows how to do that. And this is a great time to ask questions. Candace.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Stephanie F. Your line is now open.
Yes, thank you so much. This has been an excellent seminar, Carolyn Nestor, Dr. Nestor. My question has been asked before, but I do want to ask again. I was taking Taxol for 2 months, 9 years ago, and I'd like to ask Dr. Lucatori about, I was taking alpha lipoic acid 3 times a day for the peripheral neuropathy to develop in my hands and feet, mostly the hands, and taking also vitamin B6 and B12. And also, I recently started the cold laser therapy. It's called Class C cold laser for my hands. I'd like to know what research is being done on these particular therapies. Thank you so much.
Well, Stephanie, thanks for asking that question. Do you want to address that? I know Stephanie has asked that on some other programs, so I just want to check in with you if it's not quite on the topic today, but still, I think it's regarding her neuropathy. So.
Yes. Stephanie, as you indicate, the question is whether alpha lipoic acid and this cold therapy after the neuropathy has occurred, whether these have shown any benefit. Neuropathy can be a disabling side effect, and there are many studies that are being conducted to not only treat it, but also to prevent it. As I mentioned before, the only data that exists for the cold in terms of neuropathy is if it is used prophylactically. In other words, when you are receiving the chemotherapy, holding the ice packs or the cold packs in your hands and feet during the infusion to prevent the chemotherapy from reaching your hands and feet and the tiny little nerves that lead to the neuropathy. The studies with alpha lipoic acid and the two other ingredients the vitamins that you mentioned, have been conducted. They have not shown significant improvement in the neuropathy once it has been established. What is being used, although it has also not been consistent with the data that has been published in terms of benefit, are drugs called GABA agonists, such as pregabalin or gabapentin. The problem with the treatment of neuropathy is that there is no cogent or uniform approach to the treatment of neuropathy, and that it is treated in a different way across many different institutions all over the world. So at the moment, if the neuropathy is characterized by absence of sensation, there is very little that can be done. But if it is characterized by the sensation of pain or pins and needles, medications such as topical medications that contain anesthetics or the use also of these GABA agonists can minimize this disabling sensation of pins and needles so that you can conduct your daily activities and maintain the best use of your hands and feet possible.
Thank you. Our next question, Candace.
And your next question comes from Carol L. Your line is now open.
Hi, this is Carol K. Lynn calling from the San Francisco Bay Area. Dr. Ho, you mentioned that basal cells can actually morph into other organs and lungs. You didn't mention anything similar to squamous cell. I have squamous cell cancer in my cornea of my left eye.
Okay. For that question, Carol, Dr. Ho, can you address this question?
Yeah, no, thank you for clarifying. My intention was to attribute that propensity to spread to other organs to both diseases. So when we talk about advanced skin cancers, whether it be advanced basal cell cancers, advanced squamous cell cancers, not only can these tumors be invasive and become problematic in the areas in the skin in which they arise, but they also have the possibility or the propensity to spread to other parts of the body and other organs. Again, this entity of and that specific type of cancer is something we call metastatic cancer, and metastatic skin cancers, a subset of advanced skin cancers, is a rare entity, but is a possibility for both diseases. In each of those cases, drug therapy can often be considered to manage or to control those tumors. Having said that, the one thing I didn't get to in my short time is that in select cases, surgery or radiation for specific tumors can be considered. So even if you have metastatic disease with several different tumors, let's say in the liver or the lung or in the bone, if one particular lesion in the bone is causing a problem such as pain or a spinal collapse, etc., addressing that particular region to improve one's symptoms, such as radiation or surgery, can be considered. While drug therapy is often a treatment of choice in those situations because you want to administer the drug so that it can be taken and distributed throughout the body to treat multiple tumors, in select cases, radiation or surgery can be used to also achieve palliative effects.
Thank you. And we have a question from one of our online participants, which I'm going to actually ask, have Dr. Ho if you would start with it, and then Dr. Lacouture, if you would both actually kind of respond to this one, but I'll start with it. If Dr. Ho would start first, I think. How are non-adherent patients that work with? I realize that this can be a most difficult problem. Mm-hmm. From one of our healthcare professionals, someone who's following up, and if you could comment on that, as well.
Well, of course, that can be challenging. I think some of that has to, and all of us physicians and patients will encounter this situation. I think one of the key things to avoiding that actually is the initial communication that happens with the physician and the patient. Not only a clear description of their disease and what the clinical situation patients find themselves into, but also all the risks and all the benefits of the treatments one is embarking upon, and then what the goals of those treatments are. And while that doesn't mitigate all of the adherence issues, I find it helpful that when patients have a clear idea of their clinical situation, what the objectives of their treatments are, and what to expect, expecting adherence and expecting the dynamic and the communications that the physician side one would expect from patients is often enhanced. In those situations where patients are not adherent to either taking their medications or following up, we on the medical side always try to do what we can to help resolve those situations, communicate why adherence is important. Because frankly, in the end, ultimately, the concern over non-adherence is really a safety issue. While these medications can be effective, as Dr. Lagatore pointed out, without proper management, surveillance, and communication, these can also be very dangerous treatments. And my main concern with patients' lack of adherence is really the impact upon the safety of the treatment for those patients.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Lockett, what did you want to add also to that?
Yes, I agree with Dr. Ho. So for advanced squamous cell carcinoma, this is really not such a big issue, of course, because these drugs are administered through the vein. So when someone goes to the oncologist's office, they will be there and they will be observed as the medication is being administered through the vein. The issue with adherence that we have, and it's not only here with advanced skin cancers or advanced basal cell carcinomas, which have the two drugs that can be taken orally, but across the entire oncology community, and even in medicine, taking pills daily is a difficult problem because sometimes people forget or they decide not to take them. They have the opportunity not to take them. They forget them or they may lose some of them. So it is a concern, I would suggest that people keep their bottles of their medications always in the same location in a place in their homes, such as in the bathroom counter or in their nightstand, where they know they will see it and they will take it every day. And remembering that it is not ideal to take the medication if, let's say, you forgot it one day to take two the next day, or or double the dose if you forget it, or try to make it up if you forget it certain days. And also to be very careful for those medications that are recommended to be taken with food or without food, to do it in such a way, because food can alter the absorption of some of these drugs. So you may be getting too little or too much when you do not take these medications in the recommended way. And similarly, if you are experiencing a lot of diarrhea and your doctor is not informed, that could be a problem, because the diarrhea could indicate that things are going through your intestines too fast and you are not absorbing the desired medications. So that's another reason why diarrhea is important to be treated effectively.
And would you actually comment about just people, when someone's traveling, going away for the weekend, in terms of their medications, being sure they have them with them, a prescription, all those things that can really be a problem when one changes one's daily routine, or even do you advise people keeping some medications with them just in case their daily routine is disrupted unexpectedly? So how does that
Yes, now with the, that's a great point, Carolyn, because it's so easy with everything going on in our lives and, you know, being overwhelmed with the certain parts of these of the condition, and perhaps there are other medical conditions that people may be also experiencing. So keeping all of this together becomes very difficult. So it's important for someone to always have a family member or someone very close to them come with them to their doctor's appointments, so that they help them remember what it was discussed that day. Keep notes, if you can, of the medications you are taking. Another thing that has made it easier for patients recently is with the ubiquity of the smartphones. Now, what some patients do is they take pictures of their of the pills or medications they are taking, so that it is easier to remember. And when traveling, it is important to always bring the bottles with the label that indicates what medication it is, so you do not run into any problems. And if you think you're going to be in a place for an extended period of time, to make sure that in case the pills run out or they get lost, that your doctor will be able to call in or send a prescription over to a pharmacy that is close to your other location. So, yes, always thinking of having a backup in terms of the knowledge of the medicines that you are taking in the forms of written notes, in the forms of photographs, and an extra supply or an extra resource in case you run out of that supply are key so that you can take the medication continuously and without interruptions.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And we have another question for the online participants. I have a small early squamous cell growth, about 1/8 of the, and this is going to be actually for Dr. Ho. I know Dr. Akatrimi wanted to also answer this as well. I have a small early squamous cell growth about 1/8 inch in diameter in my toe. The doctor says he thinks he got it all and prescribed Albera cream. I'll be returning in a few months for examination. How do I know whether I am getting the correct treatment? Should I seek a second opinion? So, Dr. Ho, if you could address this.
Well, you know, I think it's always hard to comment on the specifics of a particular case, but I generally always recommend that if patients are wondering about a second opinion, they should seek a second opinion. Ultimately, it is your health, and more importantly, one needs to feel comfortable with the medical treatment that one is receiving. And in the end, some patients get concerned about how obtaining a second opinion is perceived by their treating physicians. But in all honesty, most practicing physicians welcome second opinions and understand the motivation for patients seeking those opinions. And so, I think ultimately, if for your own peace of mind and for your own satisfaction, if you're wondering about the treatment of a not so straightforward skin cancer or in other situations, seeking a second opinion, I think is totally reasonable. I think the flip side is also true, though, that sometimes seeking too many opinions can be paralyzing. So sometimes we see patients who have seen 4, 5, 6 different opinions for the same problem, and then are paralyzed by all the different options or opinions that sometimes can be conveyed. So there can be situations where repeated opinions is not helpful, but certainly one second opinion to review the case and to see how another institution or another practitioner would recommend treatment is certainly reasonable.
And Dr. Lockhart, do you want to add also to this?
Yes, Carolyn. I think Dr. Ho's comments were ideal. I think if someone is thinking of a second opinion, that is just the moment where one should really seek for that second opinion. And most doctors are very accepting of it. In this case, it sounds from a dermatologic perspective that again difficult without seeing the actual lesion or without looking at the pathological specimen, but it sounds like it's an early, very early squamous cell carcinoma in which treatment with surgical removal should suffice. And the use of the imiquimod medication is probably meant for the prevention of a recurrence or reappearance of this lesion. So certainly it seems like if anything, the treatment perhaps was enough, but a second opinion would be warranted for peace of mind.
Thank you. And this question is another online question, actually for Dr. Lockhart-Tour. Just like a general question, how do I move on? I worry that the cancer may come back. I check my skin constantly, visit my doctor every few months, lather on sunblock all the time. I don't even want to go outside much anymore. My friends say I'm being silly. What else can I do?
Yes, this is a very important question and comment, and I feel bad sometimes when I hear from any patients that they have skin cancer and they do these kinds of things. They don't go out during the day, or they go out with their families on vacation and they end up staying in the hotel room the entire time. And I don't really think that's the proper way to approach survivorship, although it is very difficult, and it's understandable why one would worry about it like this. So there appear to be two components here. The first component is that certainly psychological support is important. Being a survivor, as the name implies, you have survived a very difficult situation that could have been potentially even more serious, and that leads to, although it's not usually mentioned this way, to it is indeed a traumatic event in one's life. So seeking a specialist that can help you cope and understand this process, believe it or not, talking about it is extremely helpful. People like psychologists or psychiatrists that are familiar with cancer survivorship are incredibly helpful in helping people manage this feeling of anxiety when one notices something in their skin or when one is going to be exposed to the sun or go outside. The second component from this question is that even if you were to be very careful with the sun, you should be able to do almost everything that someone else who has not had skin cancer would be doing. If you go outside with proper sun protection, using sunscreen with a sun protection factor of at least 30 every 2 hours or every hour if swimming or sweating, using sun protective clothing that with a broad brimmed hat and sunglasses and long sleeve shirts if it is very sunny outside, and avoiding the times of the day when the sun intensity is the greatest, such as between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., you should be okay to go outside and enjoy life with your family and friends and not allow the previous diagnosis to limit you in such a way. So I understand the issue that you mentioned as a survivor, and I would encourage you to seek an expert to help you not only with the emotional support, but also better information as to how to protect yourself against another type of skin cancer.
Well, thank you so much. That was really quite an excellent answer. Thank you very much. It's just very compassionate and very helpful. And Dr. Hoder, did you want to add anything? Or?
No, I think I think Dr. Lockett has covered all the important things, and I think it is a natural part of the process, and I think one that needs to be dealt with sometimes in a professional manner and also on the personal side.
Thank you. They're excellent. And, well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been phenomenal today. This has been an amazing call. And I also want to thank all of you who've been listening and participating on today's call. And now, for those of you, I have said in case you didn't get your question, I will tell you how to get your questions answered. So indeed, for those of you who still have medical questions, like about your advanced basal cell or squamous cell cancers, of course you want to speak to your healthcare team. They know all about you and they have the most information to help you. But sometimes people like to check with really places that are evidence-based, that are good places to go to. So we often recommend the National Cancer Institute because they keep information on all of the appropriate treatments for all types of cancers, everything that's new out there. So we would suggest that you would contact the National Cancer Institute. There are two ways to contact them. One is to dial their 800 number. It's 800-422-6237. And you'll all be getting that information in your materials after the call with the evaluation. Or you can visit their website at www.cancer.gov. And they have a live chat feature where you can actually post your question. So for people in the United States and also international participants who just want to get this information online and visit a website, you can actually post your question, and the information specialist will then search their databases, get the information back to you, and you can have a back-and-forth conversation to get information. That's a very credible resource to contact. In addition, for those of you who would like to take advantage of any cancer care services, either the practical or financial assistance, or get some sort of counseling services, and I think talk with someone about your concerns or worries, just getting on with your life with your cancer, I would suggest that you would contact our cancer care number, our counseling line number at 800-813-4673. Or you may visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Again, you can post your question there, and you'll be assigned to one of our oncology social workers, or if you call us, you'll be assigned to one of our oncology social workers. Most importantly, as we are about to conclude the call today, I wouldn't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with cancer. I want you to now know that you're part of the cancer care community, and to some extent, we're here for you. And there are lots of resources out there, including your healthcare team, and we want you to take full advantage of those resources. Sometimes I know people have a hard time doing that, and we are there to help you, to encourage you, and teach you ways to do that. Also, we do have some programs coming up that might be of interest to many of you. There is a part two to this series, which really focuses on melanoma. So you may know someone who might be interested in that program. Some of you have signed up for it already, but if you haven't, there's a part two. And also, there is a series that we're doing. It's called Life with Cancer, A Guide to Getting the Best Care. And when I think of the last question, it's very much a part of that whole series in terms of survivorship and really and getting on with your life and really how you handle some of the concerns that you may have. There are many. And so it is a five-part series. And it starts on May 3rd. So just to be aware of that, you will be getting information about that, but so you have kind of a heads up on it. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today and wonderful questions. Your participation, of course, always enhances the call. And I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.